Hello and welcome to the Champions for Social Good podcast, the podcast for people dedicated to social impact. I'm Jamie Serino, Director of Marketing with Blackbaud's Corporations and Foundations Division. I'm here today with Dr. Chris Stout. Dr. Chris Stout is the founding director of the award-winning nonprofit Center for Global Initiatives. He also serves on the faculty in the College of Medicine at the University of Illinois in Chicago and their Center for Global Health. Chris has traveled to more than 95 countries and has been honored with numerous humanitarian and four additional doctorates for his work. In addition, he's authored more than 35 books, including The New Humanitarians, Inspiration, Innovations, and Blueprints for Visionaries. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks a lot, Jamie. It's great to be on.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Real fascinating individual with just a few achievements there. I had trouble getting through the intro. Quite an impressive list of achievements.
Thanks.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg there. So if you could start off maybe telling us a little bit about yourself and the path that you've taken through life.
Sure, Jamie. I wish I could tell you that it's been sort of the result of a really well-designed and planned and executed set of specifics and directions, and it really hasn't. I had done a blog a while back on LinkedIn called The Accidental Humanitarian, and I really oftentimes sort of felt like, you know, it really sort of spoke to kind of how I wound up doing a lot of the things that I've been up to for the last 15 years. But basically, long story short, I started off as an undergraduate, as in like computer science of all things, and architecture, and then migrated into psychology and really found that I enjoyed that. And what everyone does with an undergrad degree in psychology is apply to graduate school, so that's what I did. And had visions of you know, being in private practice and seeing adult patients. Wound up, after I got my doctorate and my license, seeing children and seeing inpatients. And I'd always kind of parallel to that had sort of this itch of you know, liking to travel and go other places and meet new people, and kind of once I got my feet underneath me after graduate school and getting started in my academic and professional activities, wanted to do some, like, have an experience with a humanitarian organization. So connected up with Flying Doctors of America and did a trip about 3 weeks in Vietnam in the late 1990s, and just really felt like that was an impactful experience. And I'm really, you know, I think a lot of people feel like sometimes they get more out of that experience, you know, emotionally and in their core, mm-hmm. than maybe, you know, what the work was that they did. And sort of one thing led to another. I did some stuff with the World Economic Forum and got to rub elbows with a lot of really amazing people that had started non-governmental organizations and 501c3s. And one thing led to another, and I had sort of had this history of climbing and met some people in Africa that we kept in touch and tried to do some work with, and realized that in addition to sort of like my day job and activities, I really sort of had this itch that I wanted to scratch about getting more involved in humanitarian work. And one thing led to another, and my mentor basically said, you know, you involve yourself in these projects and there's things that you're kind of starting on your own, but you actually really need to, you know, if you want to get donations and really kind of make it a real thing, you need to create a 501c3. So he's an attorney, his wife was an attorney, and they collaborated and helped us get through the IRS vetting process. And just actually, it's our anniversary in 2007, we officially became the Center for Global Initiatives, officially became a 501c3. And we've been involved in a variety of different kinds of projects prior to being official and since being official.
That's great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Happy anniversary.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm glad you segued into that. So I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about the Center for Global Initiatives and what you guys do and how you guys help, and maybe also a little bit of advice for people and starting off their own 501c3.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I tell you, it it really was kind of a situation in which in clinical work, there's something called informed consent, where you tell a patient sort of what to expect either in a research project or a certain kind of treatment. And I felt like no one ever gave me informed consent about starting a 501c3.
Right.
Because if they would have, I'd have been going, well, maybe this isn't exactly what I want to be doing. But there's really kind of a lot of moving parts to it, and a lot of rigors and things like that. I mean, the our attorney mentor colleagues that are volunteered. I should probably also say the Center for Global Initiatives is an entire volunteer organization. So we have our friends globally that we partner with, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But everybody here stateside, our attorneys, our web designer, all of our staff, so to speak, our directors are all volunteers, myself included. We don't get salaries or anything like that. We all have day jobs and do this as sort of our passion project and something that we feel can be kind of helpful to the world. And one of the things that when we first started it was basically, I'd done this travel and made relationships. And as we started to kind of get into more resource poor areas, people would say, hey, could you help us out with this project? Hey, we would like to do this. Hey, we would like to do that. And because they were friends and colleagues, it'd be like, yeah, sure, let's see if, I may have a network that could help us do that or help you do that, or who do I know? How do I know what kinds of resources there might be, things like that. And that all went along just swimmingly for about 3 or 4 years. And we got projects in Tanzania and Bolivia and Cambodia and India, et cetera. Not a ton of places, but pretty much ensconced in the places where we've got things. And then I guess our reputation kind of grew a bit, and we had some new friends contact us that were from Ukraine, and they wanted to do a project there, and they were wanting it to be funded by a USAID grant. And one of the obligations of the grant was that it was going to be a 3-year duration, and that it would require some assessments that would be done at these places called internats in Kiev, probably 3 to 4 times a year, and each one of those visits would probably take 10 days to 2 weeks. And as we were kind of vetting it with my board, it was sort of like, we kind of were looking at each other going, well, man, I don't have that kind of vacation time. And wow, right. My family would just really be upset if, I was going to say, well, hey, I'm not going on vacation with you guys at all this year, but I'm going to go to Ukraine 4 times or, something like that. So we really kind of realized that we couldn't, in that sense, scale in the way that we had wanted to do. And then it was sort of like this, kind of like a Waterloo / epiphany, because, first of all, we were like going, oh man, this is not cool. But then on the other hand, we got to noodling on it and thought, there have been a lot of learning experiences that we've had. There's been a lot of things that we've built. There's been a lot of resources that we've come upon and cataloged and organized that other people could use. And that kind of our shift in philosophy was that we wanted to do what we're kind of jokingly referred to as open sourcing humanitarian intervention. And what we mean by that is that it's as bizarre as this may seem. I mean, those of your listeners that work in the humanitarian space will know that this is exactly the case. But sometimes it's really hard to just do good in the world. There's lots of regulations. There's lots of red tape. There are certain places where there's concerns about corruption. I mean, there's just lots of hassles to do things. And I have had dozens of conversations with people that say, I want to do this project in Timbuktu or wherever, and I don't want to build a website. I don't want to submit my materials to the IRS to get 501c3 status. I don't want to develop a board of directors. I don't want to learn how to manage volunteers. I don't want to get a new phone number and rent office space and do, these umpteen kinds of things infrastructure-wise that you really kind of have to do to be a legitimate entity to do these things. So we then sort of came upon this idea of open sourcing kind of the hard work. And all the stuff that we've done is public domain, available to anybody that would like to come to our website anytime that they like and download to their heart's content. And the idea is that it's hard enough to do good in the world without having to worry about, what's your social media platform or what's this or what's that. So we provide a variety of different kinds of tools. Our specific sweet spot is global health and education. So that's the primary of the kinds of stuff that you'll find on our website. You won't find a whole lot about engineering or digging wells or building bridges or good roads, which are also important, but that's not our area of expertise. So you can come to our website. People can come to our tools section, for example, and they can download a spreadsheet that has 8 different tabs in it that provide information about fundraising, about getting funding from a variety of sources if you're a 501c3 or if you're not a 501c3, all these kinds of things that we kind of did in our process of building our 501c3, and we make them available to others. We help people. Like I did not know that because of my naivete that when you have a nonprofit in the United States, you file taxes, but you don't file taxes like the rest of us do as individuals with 1040s. You do something called a 990. And that looks, mm-hmm. we're based out of Chicago, and that's very different in the state of Illinois than it is in other states. And there's a federal version of it, too. And it's sort of like, I had no idea how to do that. And a lot of other, when we were filling out our application, a lot of people, you know, you say, well, I could answer this question 2 or 3 different ways. I'm really not sure kind of what they're trying to get at. So what we do pro bono for people, you know, just for asking, is to say, you know, would you like to have help filling out, if you do want to become a 501c3, of how to fill out the IRS forms for that? Would you like to see a sample of what a 990 tax form looks like submitted to the federal government? And just kind of take the question marks and clear the fog and help people kind of understand a variety of the kinds of aspects that really it takes either to develop your own 501c3, or we can act as a financial or fiscal intermediary and help people do the projects that we want to do without having to go through all the hassle of actually becoming a 501c3 and building out all that infrastructure.
Yeah, that's great. So there are a few things there. So for folks that don't want to form that, you know, 501c3, they can go to your website, they can check out some resources there. So just some questions around that. You know, what is interesting is, I mean, what I've seen in the sector is a sort of tightening up around, you know, goals and where money is being directed to, and a sort of like, so I think that sort of supports more of like, you know, I don't know, for lack of a better term, like the paperwork part of it. Mm-hmm. But on the other side of that coin is the complete like sort of DIY attitude mm-hmm. that's out there now of like, hey, I see a problem, I'm just going to try to solve it or work towards solving it. And so do you see those two things? And in a way, do they ever conflict? And do you guys sit in the middle of that? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Excellent question, Jamie. I think it's something that I think a lot of people wrestle with. I think, you know, it's certainly something that that we have concerns about. And I'll tell you, I mean, very frankly, you know, there are entities that I mean, we've seen this in our newspapers here in the Chicago area that, you know, kind of funnel money to nefarious causes, you know, and yeah. It's sort of like, hey, I thought I was supporting this, and lo and behold, I'm, you know, supporting that. So there's entities like GuideStar and others where people can kind of, you know, look and vet a charity or a charitable organization or a foundation if they're not familiar with it, or if they're not, you know, kind of sure, you know, if it's kind of like the good housekeeping seal of approval. Is this legit? Mm-hmm. And what's a third party that's going to do this? Because I don't have the time. I don't have the wherewithal. I don't know, you know, the difference between a, you know, a great thing like a Red Cross and something else that sounds just like the Red Cross, but, you know, but I saw it, you know, at a bake sale or something. So there's right. those kinds of tools out there. On the do-it-yourself thing, I mean, it's. I love that you said that. We actually have a spot on our website called DIY Humanitarianism, and the idea behind that is exactly kind of what your point was, that people, you know, have a, you know, a desire to do things. A lot of the people that I interviewed for the New Humanitarians book, you know, felt like they wanted to be more activistic and more involved and have more skin in the game than just writing a check for a cause that they cared about, or maybe right. they saw, maybe they've got personal experience with it, maybe they have some other kind of connection or even some other kind of expertise where they could kind of bring more to it. And again, maybe they have the time or the bandwidth or the gumption or the grit or whatever it takes to kind of do that. So in those instances, you know, they started their own 501c3s and, you know, are doing fantastic work. And again, I think there's a group of people that are kind of in between. Maybe it's not, you know, I can volunteer and that's great. Maybe volunteering also is kind of my, you know, entry into, you know, seeing if I really like this and trying it on and seeing how things work. or saying, you know, hey, this isn't for me and this isn't what I want to do. So on the do-it-yourself side, I think a lot of people, you know, maybe through their religious affiliation in their churches, maybe through their work, maybe through their Rotary clubs and their Lions clubs and their whatever service organizations and things like that. We also help those folks. Like, for example, we have a relationship with a wonderful organization called Fly for Good. One of the biggest problems that most volunteers have in the sense of going over and being involved in a service project is the airfare to get there. It's even in, you know, even I heard someone say, you know, I feel like I got duct taped onto the wing. You know, I had such inexpensive seats. But even with being duct taped to the wing, it can still be, you know, pretty expensive to go. And a lot of these folks are retired. A lot of these folks, you know, have they might be students or graduate students or whatever. It's not like you have like a big disposable income to pay even for a coach ticket to Africa or to someplace. But usually once you're in country, costs are very, very minimal, the room and board, so to speak, because you're in, you know, very basic settings, and food and stuff like that isn't the problem. So Fly for Good, for example, is sort of like a humanitarian Expedia or Travelocity or something. So you can come to our website, or if you have your own 501c3 or church group or whatever kind of nonprofit, you can develop a relationship with them as well. Or we can skip that step for you and you can just do it through our center. And as long as you're going on an international mission, it's not like you could go to a reservation in South Dakota and do something. That's one of their criteria. Mm-hmm. It has to be overseas. Then you can, you know, put in what your trip is and what you're wanting to do and where you're wanting to go. They also allow you an extra baggage allowance, which oftentimes you're bringing materials, maybe it's books or meds, right, or durable medical, right, equipment, which is nice because that's at no charge. And a lot of times trips, especially if they're smaller things, can, you know, flights can get canceled and weird stuff can happen. So they have I think it's like about half the price of like a regularly ticketed, if you kind of do it through normal channels, if you needed to change your flights or something. And I've used them personally probably at least 4 trips to Africa. I had one trip that got kind of sideways, and they were just super helpful at you know, kind of fixing things and getting things straightened out and stuff. So
it's great.
Yeah, highly recommend them. And again, it's sort of like one of those things. There's no magic that, you know, that we know about them or whatever. It's just they're a great partner, and we've, through the process of building our site up and our organization, found them. Highly recommend them. They have our kind of good housekeeping seal of approval. And yep, you know, we don't get any kickbacks. We don't have an affiliate relationship with them or anything like that. We don't have anything like that on our site. So people can feel like if it's on our site, it's on our site because we like it. It's not because we're getting a commission or anything like that. It's just, it's all very, very, very transparent. But our site, we really kind of want to be this collection of tools for folks to be able to come in, do the kind of work they want to do, not be hassled by it, not spend days on Google trying to find things, and just really making it, you know, easy for people to do good in the world.
Right. That's fantastic. And do you ever work with companies or corporations? Is it just on the individual level, or do you find yourself working with companies and corporations that are also looking to do a similar thing of connecting their people with causes and finding, you know, they're raising their hand, mm-hmm, about something, who else is raising their hand about something?
Yeah, we at minor levels, I mean, we've done it with students and universities and graduate schools, which aren't really corporations. And we've done it, I also serve as vice president of research and data analytics for ATI Physical Therapy, and they have a program called Mission Works. And we've worked collaboratively with them as well for staff to be able to go on a Mission Works trip, providing physical therapy and orthopedic rehabilitative services, where donors, like, so they, Aunt Sally and Uncle Charlie may want to donate for it. Mission Works isn't a 501c3, so that's one of those instances where we act as a fiscal intermediary. We don't take a percentage, we don't take a commission or anything like that. We do totally transparent accounting and spreadsheeting of all people's donations. And then people could make donations. That funded the staff member's ability to then go over an ATI, and their program covers half of that person's costs. So it was really kind of a cool way where people could feel like they could, you know, get donors, not have to worry about that whole hassle, because that wasn't what they wanted. But their goal wasn't to go, oh gosh, I really want to get donors for things. That's really what I want to do. Of course not. They want to go do the service and go have that experience. So we help those kinds of things to be an accelerant or and to augment it, to make it a lot easier for folks. And, you know, I would be more than happy, you know, if your listeners have connections with companies. We just really haven't sought out companies. Again, we tend to be kind of more people knock on our door and we open up and see how we can help, rather than us specifically going out and looking for folks.
Okay, that's great. So in the work that you're doing, how do you measure success?
Well, I think accountability is a big issue, and I think that's a big issue with donors, you know, with any kind of entity. I think there's much more of it's a very nice and reasonable desire for any donor to kind of say, you know, hey, what does my dollar pay for? You know, what benefit, what bang literally for the buck does this occur? And I see it a lot of times, you know, just come through the holidays and I see things like Goodwill vans driving down the street, and they'll have like a very large picture of someone that works at Goodwill, and that person saying, you know, thank you for helping me, you know, have this position and stuff like that. And it's sort of like, I love that because it really humanizes it. It really brings literally a human face to, you know, what kind of outcomes are and things like that. There's also, though, a group of folks that like to see pie charts and spreadsheets. You know, so,
right.
So we kind of like to do both. So we like on our website and through other, you know, things that we do, we have a free monthly newsletter, and we've got a Facebook site and a variety of other kinds of things that are more image friendly sorts of things rather than spreadsheet friendly sorts of things, where people got, you know, actually get to see, you know, we did a project. Well, we built a kindergarten back actually before we became a real entity in 2005. We just collaborated with a colleague of mine in Tanzania, who said, you know, we've got these kids that will have they're orphans, they have a much better likelihood of being able to get into what we would think in the West of an elementary school if they had some kind of preparatory kindergarten-like education. Mm-hmm. So I just collaborated with my friends. I'd done a lot of work back in my clinical days with schools and school districts and principals and special ed directors and things like that. So I pinged them, explained to them kind of what we were looking for. We all kind of collaborated and put this stuff, a packet of paper materials together, because I couldn't email it to him or anything. So did that and said, you know, this is, you know, very Western focused, so please bring, you know, the cultural aspects in your area to this, and, you know, make it your own. These materials are for you. He then did his component of that, submitted it to the Ministry of Education in Tanzania, and within a year's time, we had a certified kindergarten. So,
wow, nice.
Yeah, so that was kind of, you know, and that, again, isn't necessarily a spreadsheet kind of thing, but that, you know, we've got these great images of sort of like how the school started off and kind of how the school has evolved and things like that. And on the more economic side of things, my same colleague that I work with, he's a priest now, and he's also chaplain at two hospitals in the same geographic area, the Moshi region of Tanzania. And we had tried sending materials over, real costly stuff. You know, we'd send seven boxes, crates worth of stuff. Five boxes would get there. It would take forever. It cost a fortune. So we thought, you know, we're going to provide funding. And then what he then does is does a translation from U.S. dollars to Tanzanian shillings, and then, you know, gives us an accounting as to how the dollars were spent, because I have no idea how to best spend the dollars. He does. So, and we have this, you know, 20-year relationship of trust. So they were dealing with at the hospital just a really severe malaria outbreak. And so a lot of people here would just wag their finger and say, well, you know, you should have, you know, chemically treated nets, and that helps, you know, diminish malaria. And it's not like, yes, 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 I totally get that, totally agree with that. But that does nothing to help the person that's bedridden with malaria right now.
Right.
We need to, you know, to treat those folks. And that's kind of our sweet spot. You know, we do as much we can for prevention and all that, but, you know, who's the people that come in and fix the people that, you know, that didn't have the benefit of prevention? So We funded protocols of treatment. For the picture side, they sent us pictures of that. That's actually on one of our Facebook sites. But it was just really amazing to me, Jamie, because I had no idea, you know, what the results would be. And long story short, for the dollars that were sent, the purchase of medications there in country were so economical that an entire protocol for a person to go through treatment was 73 cents. 73 US cents, not even a US dollar. So we then called that the 73 cents a life project, because it was sort of like, at this level, and that's why we, even with our, you know, our fundraising and stuff like that, we say, you know, if you can just give a dollar, that'll make a big difference. You know, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
So it's those kinds of things where then we can kind of go back to our spreadsheets and pie charts and things like that and be able to say, you know, here's where, this is how we stretch a dollar. You know, we are able to, through collaboration, through not being West knows best know-it-alls and telling who's in country how to do their job. You know, our job is to create tools and to do fundraising projects and things like that. Their job is to be good stewards and administrators of the funding that comes over and report back for us, you know, that sort of a thing. And I mean, they had an issue a while back of they had a problem with getting food. They needed grain. Mm-hmm. And they even gave us, Jamie, an accountability of how much the liters of petrol cost to drive the truck to go get the bags of grain, you know. And it's sort of like, you know, stuff that we would just take for granted, you know, of just, you know, gas mm-hmm. in the car kind of thing, that there's that, you know, they're so resource poor that was a big deal, that, you know, they needed to have mm-hmm. fuel, and they were lucky that they had access to a vehicle, but so the person wasn't going to just let them have the vehicle and use the gas and not replenish it. So it's those kinds of things. I mean, again, we're very, very small.
And they just decided to, did you ask them to report on that? And they just voluntarily
totally
just
them.
Said, we're going to report on that?
Wow. Yeah, totally. And I think, again, that just speaks to, you know, our front-end job was having relationships with people. And it wasn't, mm-hmm. you know, it's everybody we work with. We feel are our friends, you know, and mm-hmm. and we don't have the hubris that, unfortunately, I think other organizations, not, you know, there's not as many, and this is diminishing, but, you know, I sort of feel like, you know, you're a guest in somebody's house, and you bring them a gift, and they, you know, give you hospitality, and you don't say, hey, you know, I think you should redo the carpet in here, and hey, I think you should, you know, change the wallpaper and rearrange the furniture. Yeah, you're a guest in somebody's house. So we really, you know, we do the part that's part of our role, and then we, you know, collaboratively work with them. If they say, you know, hey, we're thinking about changing the carpet, could you help us out with that? We're sure we can help you out with that. So
yeah, I think that's fantastic, because, and I think a lot of our listeners, you know, would like to hear that, but I think that some may say, if they are on the giving side, if they're maybe a foundation, some may struggle with mm-hmm. the organizations they work with and with measurement. And sometimes it's a resources issue. They're giving to an organization that hardly has any people, and they're just lucky to get the job done and then to go back and measure. And or some don't have the mentality, or some give pushback. And then, of course, there are a bunch that are measuring and they are doing it. Mm-hmm. And there is this great collaboration there. So you had a sort of gift there where these people were very measurement oriented, very, you know, I think resource driven. Do you ever have a struggle with, like, you know, we need to be measuring this? Because, you know, you did mention, you know, clearly, by showing the value of what was happening, you're able to get more money. Mm-hmm. You're able to continue funding. You're able to show people, 73 cents, this is what it gets you.
Right, and it's a tricky thing, Jamie. I mean, on the one hand, especially in the healthcare side of things, it's sort of like I couldn't have predicted to say, hey guys, we need to fundraise this money, because, I mean, I can say, hey, we need to fundraise because there's this problem, but I couldn't say, mm-hmm. you know, for every dollar you give, it's going to create a protocol, you know, treat, you know, X number of people or something like that. And part of, in the healthcare side of things, you know, some of the metrics are around issues that sort of take a while to bear fruit. You know, like if you think of childhood mortality rates and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, being able to move the needle on even a small population, you know, could be measured in a couple of years. So there might mm-hmm. need to be kind of an outlook or a time horizon that says, you know, that kind of informs the donor, you know, that this is the goal, this is the expectation, and this is the timeline of when, you know, we're going to be able right. to report back on that. It's, you know, if it's a group building a bridge or drilling a well, you know, they can say, well, a well is going to probably cost X number of dollars and it's going to take Y number of months. And people say, okay, great. You know, I'll do that and I'll check back mm-hmm. with you in Y number of months and see how the well went, kind of a thing. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, that part of it can be kind of tricky. But to your point, too, I mean, there can be, I think the measurement mentality, I mean, obviously I'm biased. That's what my day job is. But I think the measurement mentality can be cracked in a couple of different kinds of ways. Some creative ways is actually hooking up with health economists or students that are in health economist kinds of programs, hooking up with students that are looking for a project in a school of public health. So a lot of times, and again, I'd be happy to, you know, make connections. University of Illinois at Chicago has a tremendous school of public health. Hopkins has a tremendous school of public health. There's a number of them in, you know, major universities around the country that, you know, can at least guide people of how, what's the least costly, most scalable kind of outcomes measurements can we deploy, or can we get a student to, you know, kind of help us out pro bono on a project or something like that along those lines as well. So, but I would also just circle back and say, you know, deal with whoever your partner, your in-country partner is, you know, of kind of what's the appropriate time horizon to be able to report back, and what's a realistic expectation of how far whatever, you know, dollars or pesos or shillings or whatever it is that it might mm-hmm. be, might a donor, you know, be able to expect back in return. And honestly, you know, it can be bags of grain, it can be lives saved, and people can sort of extrapolate in the front end of it, but then certainly report back with any kind of data points that they have after the project is the dollars have been spent and the seeds have been planted, or the, you know, the live people have been treated or what have you.
Yeah, I think it is important to establish that up front. I think that really is the key there.
Yeah.
So what kinds of things are you seeing now as the big initiatives for your group? What are the most pressing issues, and what are some of the things that you're working on right now?
We've been partnering, I'd mentioned, with Mission Works, and we're continuing to kind of grow that out with being able to provide the fiscal intermediary services. And what those typically are for are physical rehabilitative kinds of things in resource poor areas. Primarily, it's been in Central and South America, but I believe that there's kind of a movement afoot to do to try a couple of scalable projects in Africa. And one of the things about those projects is that there are some entities, and again, everybody doing good is great, and I'm not being critical of anybody wanting to help out anybody, but one of the things that I think is changing in this area is a sustainability aspect. And one of the things that you don't want someone to sort of parachute in, patch people up, and then, you know, say, you know, hasta luego, and you know, we're never going to see you again, kind of a thing. So mm-hmm. a lot of the stuff that we're working on with collaborative colleagues, as well as with other entities, is the whole sustainability aspect. And again, mm-hmm. just using Tanzania as an example, sometimes it's issues around development of their educational programs. Sometimes it's issues of that it was like just a shitty weather, I'm sorry, that it was really a bad weather year, and mm-hmm. crops are down, and people are going to start to have, you know, nutrition related kinds of illnesses. So can we either backstop that with getting grain and food in, or can we, you know, are we going to then expect a downstream kind of problem with marasmus and other kinds of nutritional malnutrition kinds of issues that are going to have to be treated in the hospital? So mm-hmm. that kind of sustainability and sort of developing as best we can some kind of, you know, robustness to that are kind of the key projects that we're working on these days.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds cool. So a question comes to mind, you know, how do you marry that up? So that sort of the two streams we were talking about here, you have sustainability, you know, you're saying you don't want someone to just sort of parachute in and do something and hop on out. And then you have this measurement thing, and but you have this DIY thing, you know, and so how does that you know, kind of level set? So if you're creating an environment that's for DIY, are you creating an environment that then is like a bunch of people running around doing stuff that you can't measure, that they're parachuting in and then flying out? How do you marry that up with sustainability and everything else you were just kind of running through there?
Excellent, big question. I think part of it is the from the DIY perspective, someone has like a specific kind of, you know, there in those instances in our experiences, it's been because something bad has happened. There's been a conflict area. There has been, I'm not kidding, like a dam has broken, so to speak, you know, kind of a thing. Yeah. And there's one, there's kind of a traumatic event, either man-made or nature-made, that people are saying, you know, we've had this earthquake, we've had this tsunami, we've had this bad event, whatever that is. We've got refugees now that we didn't have before. Those all tend to be in a, I don't know, in a weird way. Those are time by situational kinds of things. Those are time-limited kinds of things. So you help patch the dam, you help deal with the sequential cholera outbreak, you you get the refugees, you know, ensconced in a better, safer area, you kind of do whatever, and then that job's done. So it's not it's not the same kind of scenario in which you've established a beachhead in Guatemala where they know that four times a year people are going to come down and work with whatever kinds of musculoskeletal kinds of traumas that people have had since the last visit, or things that are maybe age-related kinds of things that are going on with scoliosis or arthritis or other kinds of things with people's joints and bones and movement. So for the latter of that, that's the sustainability kind of thing. That's where you don't parachute in and out, because those are chronic problems, because that's how, you know, that's how Mother Nature and people's lives work. When it's been a conflict zone, or it's been an untoward unique weather event or dam burst or whatever, those aren't the parachute in and parachute out kinds of things, because, you know, the situation gets patched up and fixed, as opposed to, you know, more chronic kind of thing. So that's how we distinguish those differences. I have seen organizations that will do the fly-in, fly-out in the chronic situations, and that, in my personal opinion, is a problematic kind of thing. It creates a dependency on someone, and they ain't coming back, you know, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So, and it doesn't develop the sustainability or the resourcefulness of whoever those people are. It creates this really, in my opinion, bad kind of situation of, you know, an unrequited dependency that doesn't get reconciled unless, you know, somebody pays attention to what's going on. So that's kind of how the difference is, you know, with those kinds of things. And either which way, there's still measurable outcomes. You know, there's the outcomes of, like, for example, my Guatemala example, you know, you count how many patients were treated, you know, for the 2 weeks that you had a team there, and you keep track of those patients, and you can follow up with some of those same patients, you know, their arthritic knee 4 months later, maybe not with the same physical therapist, but with someone that, you know, has been briefed about the people they're going to be working with, so that there's that kind of continuity as well, too. I mean, here in the United States, with all the resources we have like really horrible continuity of care ourselves, you know, and putting things together. So it really gets amplified in areas where providers, you know, even if they're coming in a quasi-consistent way, let's say quarterly, to the same clinic or the same hospital or the same site or the same community, you know, there can be systems, you know, stateside to be organized to help do that. And that's been some of the projects we've been helping out with, too, sort of like virtual medical records and things along those lines.
Oh, that's pretty cool. And that leads me to another question. The UN Sustainable Development Goals, or the global goals, do they end up being a guide for you at all? Because those were coming to mind as you were talking about sustainability, and that, you know, sometimes you can work on this like small issue, or you can, you know, try to keep lifting yourself up to work on like what's the root cause of that, or, you know, or and then also, as you were saying, How can we collaborate to, you know, become bigger, to work on bigger problems? And the UN is certainly pushing that forward. And then as a part of that track, it ties into what you were just talking about. They have Impact 2030, which is an effort to get corporations to mobilize their workforces to volunteer, to make some progress towards these. And I think that there is this, you know, spoken about notion now that corporations are needed to step up. They want to, they're needed to step up, and they have the sort of power, the resources, the money to do that. So so what are your thoughts around all that?
Oh, gosh, great. Again, great integrative question. I guess maybe to kind of work backwards with answering it, like I know we had done some work in Kigali, Rwanda at a hospital there, and after our time there, one of the things that I sort of kept track about kind of the goings on and whatnot, one of the things I thought was really interesting was that I believe it was Heineken Brewery had a plant there. And one of the things that Heineken was doing was, you know, drilling wells or accessing water or whatever to make water, not just to create beer, but also to have purified drinking water available to people in the community. And they were also providing sort of in-house healthcare services to people that were employees of Heineken and their families and things. So, you know, I like that sort of a thing. I mean, we do consultations with, you know, a number of companies here in the United States where we provide on-site healthcare services and stuff too. It's not a, you know, a developing country unique kind of thing. It's a nice model, you know, other places. I've heard Coca-Cola has done similar kinds of things of, you know, providing potable water, you know, period and free of charge and stuff because they were doing it anyway. Mm-hmm. So, and there can be cons to that too. You know, you might not like sugary drinks. You might not like alcoholic drinks. You know, there's, you know, the whole, you know, kind of ethical question about, you know, that sort of a thing. But I see companies having at least that mindset, you know, coming in and saying, not just, we're not just here for, you know, creating profits, and we're not just, you know, we're part of the community. If we're going to come here, we're going to be part of the community. And I think that, you know, from my perspective, I think that's a good thing, as well as having companies provide people with, you know, time off or like what ATI does of, you know, helping offset the costs of that and making it easy to be a volunteer, not making it a hassle to be a volunteer or being terrified, you know, you're doing this good project for 10 days away someplace and what's going on back at work, you know, am I going to get in trouble because I went on this thing or whatever. So I think all the whole corporate part, you know, totally a fan of, and I think it's going to get more sophisticated and clever and innovative and whatnot would be my crystal ball guess. As far as the UN and the goal, Millennium Goals and things like that, back when the Millennium Goals first came out, they were very aspirational. They still are, so to speak, and they're very hard to accomplish. You know, that's what I think institutions like the United Nations and World Bank and World Health Organization, et cetera, kind of are there for. They're big entities, they're big institutions, they've, you know, got a big, you know, place at the table, so to speak. They've got a big pulpit that they can use for, you know, good or bad. But I think for us, we are like such a drop in the UN ocean, so to speak, and it just reminds me, there is a kind of one of my favorite authors and people is a guy named William Easterly, who's an economist at Columbia, and he did a book called The White Man's Burden, and that book was really sort of pivotal in my thinking with when I was concocting this whole idea with the center and whatnot, that it was the power of the small project and the fact that a lot of times entities like United Nations and World Banks and whatnots get to a certain point where there's such, you know, bureaucracy and politics and whatevers that sometimes it makes it sort of hard to do the work. And we're kind of on the opposite end of that in a William Easterly kind of perspective to say, you know, we're the power of the small project. We're the ones that'll, you know, kind of be there to help the people either in country that we already have partnerships with or help those that want to help those to make it easier for them to be able to provide that. And so we're no competition. The UN does not need to worry about the Center for Global Initiatives.
Right.
And we don't count on the UN to kind of, you know, do anything that we're involved with. I did a year stint as an NGO representative back in the late 90s on, coincidentally enough, on sustainability. And, you know, I sort of have this love-hate relationship with the UN. I think I love the spirit of it. I love the the goals, the things that it's done, the accomplishments it's been able to do. But the problems are that, it's a big ship to steer, and it's hard to, mm-hmm. Kind of hit, we talked about outcomes and results. It's really sort of hard to hit any of the outcomes and results that they want. And part of that's by design, because like we said, they're aspirational kinds of goals. But I think, the kind of working from both ends, from the big ends with lots of dollars and lots of connections and lots of really, really smart people, and the small ends of, John and Jane Q. Public, in a Chicago suburb that wants to do a project to help people out in, rural Haiti. That those are all good things, and they're all in my book, kind of equivalent. One doesn't trump the other. They're all, good people wanting to do good work at whatever level of scale, and hopefully at the end of the day there's benefits to whoever it is that they're wanting to work with and help out.
Yeah, I think that the UN is putting, a notion like that forward with the goals that, if there's focus at least. So if you have small projects, big projects, but if they're all focused on, one of these goals, then we will make progress towards them.
I would agree with that.
And I think they are realizing that they can't do it alone, and they need, these other groups out there, and people like you, and corporations, and right down to the individual level. Which I think we're seeing a lot of. So,
well, and I think we hear this too on your podcast with your guests. I mean, the people that that you interact with and stuff. I mean, they get that, and it's nice to it. The nice thing is things don't feel to me today versus maybe a decade ago as discombobulated, disjointed, working at odds, sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea how that happened, but it seems better than the chaos that it used to be. I'll tell you that.
Right.
So that's
a great note to end on there, Chris. So I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure, Jamie.
It was great conversation. I look forward to, continuing our dialogue. For our listeners, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Champions for Social Good. To learn more about Dr. Chris Stout and the Center for Global Initiatives, you can visit centerforglobalinitiative.org. You can also check out some of Chris's LinkedIn influencer blogs on LinkedIn, and just kind of search for those through there. You can follow Chris on Twitter at Dr. Chris Stout. And you can connect with him via drchrisstout.com. So lots of ways. I encourage you to go out there and interact. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss an episode. And you can keep up with the conversation between episodes by following us on Twitter at Jamie Serino, at MicroEdge LLC, and at BlackBod. Thank you for listening.